atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Jay. How are you doing at the end of what I'm sure was another busy week for you of dispensing some sort of justice?
It was. This was a busy week fighting for freedom here. I don't have anything clever to say.
No, freedom never sleeps. I understand it occasionally naps, yes. But that's about the best you can do. So, and we have so much to talk about. This is one of these weeks where it was a question of what stories can we fit in, and between the regular show and the bonus show, we'll try to get as much as we can, but there is an awful lot. Before we do get to it, I do want to thank, though, Shane and Isabel. They're our newest Patreon supporters. They actually both took advantage of our free trial week, and now they're regular full-time supporters. And as always, you know, there's no way we'd be doing this 800-some episodes later if it weren't for supporters like Shane and Isabel. So thank you guys very much. We really do appreciate it. One other thing before we get started with our show, I want to let everyone know about two other podcasts I think you might like. The first is one of our fellow Democracy Group shows called The Bully Pulpit. And right away with that name, Jay, you got to know I love it, right? Being a TR fan that I am. So they're from the Center for the Political Future at University of Southern California. And they basically bring together top Republicans, Democrats. They try to transcend partisan divisions, explore practical solutions to national and global challenges. Kind of, you know, like, I'd like to think
that's,
we, what
that's
we
like
do.
Us.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we're part of the same group. And so their belief is that, like us, opponents are adversaries, not enemies. And if you lose, you shouldn't burn down the stadium. And I'm all for that, for sure.
Right.
Now, the other podcast I recommend is one that's especially near and dear to my heart, well, because I'm on it. And that's, of course, Sustainable Planet. And the creator and my co-host is my wife, Kimberly. She's also a political scientist. She has spent a ton of time, many years, thinking about researching sustainability. She knows a ton about this stuff. I try to keep up. I think I do a reasonably good job. And we've already talked about a bunch of things like why sustainability matters, what it is, consumerism, food waste, animal agriculture, commodity fetishism, which maybe doesn't sound as kinky as you'd think it would. But anyway,
that's kind of hot. Yeah.
Interesting.
Wheat futures.
We also look at what regular people can do to try to live more sustainability, you know, sustainable lives without, like I always say, buying a yurt and moving out into the wilderness somewhere or something like that. You don't have to do that. You know, it's probably a problem. Anyway, the point being is I hope you'll check both of those podcasts out, and you can find them both, Sustainable Planet and The Bully Pulpit. Well, you know, wherever you get your podcasts, but we'll also put links to each of them in today's show notes. All right. So, Jay, I don't know if you heard, but there's some kind of a trial with Donald Trump. Did you happen to catch that in the news?
Yeah. Yes.
But big so, news. Yeah, the first criminal trial of Donald Trump, that's the so-called hush money trial, right? Those 34 counts of falsifying business records related to those Stormy Daniels payments made through fixer Michael Cohen. And now, normally, as we pointed out before on the show, falsifying business records is a misdemeanor, but New York law allows them to be a class E felony, which is as low as a felony goes, if the records were falsified with an intent to commit another crime, although Trump hasn't been charged with any underlying other crimes, but that's not actually a requirement. Now, Jay, you and I have talked about the charges before, and I mean, it's a huge story, but we don't really do blow-by-blow trial coverage here on the politics guys. And there are plenty of other podcasts if you want that kind of thing. It's just not our thing. But I did feel like it so dominated so much of the news that I should at least mention it and also let people know that once there is a verdict or if there's some shocking development, we'll certainly talk about that. But the standard sort of like, oh, this person testified in more or less the way we thought they would, it's not going to be something we're going to spend a lot of time on. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
That tends to be more news reporting than opinion journalism, which is more of what we do.
Exactly. So I will just say to everyone, if you're looking for that, stay tuned. We will talk about it, but just not right now. So there we go. Now, one thing I do want to talk. Wait, did you hear that? Yeah.
Something just happened.
Yeah, that is the sound of Jay taking a well-deserved victory lap. So back in 2023, and actually a number of times since then, I said I didn't see a path forward for additional aid to Ukraine until after the 2024 elections. And even then, only if Biden was reelected and Democrats took the House. But Jay, on the other hand, thought that House Republicans would, in the end, in the bitter, bitter end, do the right thing. And well, sort of, right? I mean, so what I mean by sort of is Speaker Johnson did what
probably a billionaire passes or it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. And so Mike Johnson did what I see as the right thing. He allowed a vote on that $61 billion or so in Ukraine aid. And that was something that, of course, you know, 311 to 112 had passed, a large majority of the House wanted. But, and this is why I say sort of, while every Democrat voted for it who was voting, a majority of Republicans voted no, 112 to 101 in favor of it. And the fact that Johnson even brought it to a vote goes against that so-called Hastert rule, which is, it's not really a rule. It's more of a practice than a rule. And it's the practice whereby the Speaker of the House doesn't allow floor votes on anything a majority of his or her party's caucus is opposed to, as this vote would suggest was the case for the Republican Party. Now, there were also a number of other military aid votes in that same week, their individual bills at the House. There was the $26 billion in aid for Israel. That was even more popular. That vote was 366 to 58, with the no votes coming from 37 Democrats and 21 Republicans. There was a third supplemental aid bill, the Indo-Pacific Security Bill, or the Taiwan Aid Bill, as I think it's been more informally referred to. That was the least amount of money and the most popular, $8 billion, 385 to 34. All 34 no votes came from Republicans who apparently hate Taiwan and love China. I don't know. We'll talk about that in a minute. But and there was also this fourth bill, a TikTok ban. We're going to talk about that separately, so we'll kind of hold on that. But they were all rolled into a single measure in the Senate, which passed at 79 to 18. And 15 of those no votes came from Republicans in the Senate. They were joined by Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley, as well as both of Vermont senators, Peter Welch, and independent Democratic socialist guy, Bernie Sanders. So, Jay, I got at least to start off two questions for you. The first is what you think of Speaker Johnson going against what seems to be a majority of his own party on Ukraine, and then kind of rolled into that related. Why does it seem like the Republican Party, in the House at least, is now seemingly an isolationist party? So take it however you want.
Well, yeah, on the one hand, well, they call them an isolationist party. They did pass the bill.
Well, the majority of the bill, Congress did,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm just saying a majority of the Democrats, the Republicans in the House, if we are to take their votes as an indication of their viewpoints, would have not done that.
Yeah. But the speaker that they elected, who decides which bills get to the House floor, put it on the floor. So that tells me that, look, Johnson knew that the votes were going to be there, even if they weren't all coming from his caucus. It also tells me he is savvy enough to realize, you know, which members need to take a walk and which ones can stick with him. And he's good at counting. So I think those are all good attributes in a speaker. And I think he really pulled off something important here. Again, I would, if it were up to me, would I rather have seen more Republicans voting for Ukraine aid? Yeah. But it's not, you know, it's a pass-fail test. And the speaker got the bill to the floor and he got it passed.
And, so, you know, I'm glad you bring that up, that idea about taking a walk, because in my mind, at least, I think, and I certainly could be wrong, I'm wrong about more things, you know, like before 9 a.m. than many people are all day. But it seems to me likely that in private conversations, there were a number of House Republicans who said to Johnson, listen, I'm going to vote no on this. You've got the votes. It's going to be a lot better for me politically.
Exactly.
Yes. I might even be saying some stuff on social media and so forth, but I get what you're doing. I'm actually in favor of it. Now, there are those people who are just flat out against it, certainly the Republicans, right. But I still am not convinced that's anywhere close to a majority of the caucus. Though I guess you could argue, well, does it matter?
Well, 112 to 102, I mean, it's 10.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a majority of the caucus that voted against it. Now, some people might say, well, it doesn't matter what they might believe in their heart of hearts. If they're going to vote against it, then they are, for all intents and purposes, against it. And I would say again, well, maybe, but maybe not, right? Because, again, of that idea of how many votes can you afford to lose for political purposes sort of thing.
Right. And if you've got members who, if you can get done what you need to get done without putting members in jeopardy, then you do that.
What about, you know, I may be a little more curious about that relatively tiny in relation Taiwan, basically aid bill. I mean, does it seem weird that there would be 34 House Republicans who would vote against? It seems to me that if you're looking for a hardcore of isolationist sort of America firsters, it might be those 34.
Yeah, I don't get that either. And I'm not sure. My position, my read on this, right, from the beginning, is less that House Republicans, Republicans in general, are opposed to aid in Ukraine or opposed to Ukraine, but rather they see other issues as higher priorities and have a tough time justifying to their constituents, look, why are we spending money in Ukraine when X, the border is open, or you know, fentanyl's flowing across, or whatever the case may be, right? So I don't think that, like I said, I don't see that there was a caucus out there. Not that there aren't some, right? That they're, as you said, the hardcore isolationists. But I think by and large, back when we were talking about this, when it was a Ukraine tied to a border deal, my sense was, yeah, most of, if they got the border deal, most of the Republicans would be okay with the Ukraine thing. It's not that they intrinsically are against Ukraine. Now there's, I don't know, other stuff that goes on, that the sense that, you know, Ukraine is some sort of Biden project because he supported it, and so we'll oppose it. And that there were, you know, Biden shenanigans relating to Ukraine and all that, and all that's true. But I in my view, that doesn't change our strategic interest in having a safe and secure Europe and Vladimir Putin not expanding his reach.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't agree with all that is true, but I would agree with, even if all of that is true, then the rest of what you said follows. Now, I'll point out, too, that there's another argument aside from the, well, this is a Biden sort of slushy sort of whatever kind of thing, whether you believe that or not. Shouldn't we fix the border first or what have you, fentanyl or you name it. Fentanyl. But I would say there's another argument. The other argument, I think, was presented maybe most notably in my mind by Ohio Senator J.D. Vance a few weeks ago. He had a New York Times op-ed piece where he basically argued that, listen, we need to have some sort of a commitment from Ukraine to that they need to essentially, what he would argue is, accept reality that they're not going to expel Russia from all of Ukraine, and that we're not just going to throw money at this problem that can't be solved at the cost of lives and destruction. If they want our support, then they have to show us some sort of a defensive strategy and enter into some kind of brokered negotiations with Russia and so forth. Now, I think he's wrong on a lot of levels, but that is an argument that's out there that some people on the right believe is a very cogent and powerful argument.
Yeah, and I'm kind of to there, sort of like Neville Chamberlain, your office is calling. You know what I mean? What Chamberlain said to the Czechs and the Sudetenland of, look, hey, come on, you gotta accept it. We're gonna have peace here. I'm not sure what more I can say other than that hasn't been the traditional Republican view. And I think it's misguided. I think And look, even if your goal is to say, you know, maybe from a strategic standpoint, you realize, look, we're not going to oust Putin from all of Ukraine. We just don't have the military force to do it. And it would take, you know, cost so many more lives. We're not going to get him out of Crimea, for example, where he's been for 10 years now, more than that. But, you know, it's one thing to have that realization. It's another thing to go and say it out loud.
Well, I think it's right.
This is our strategy. It's one what you say is, no, we're going to fight to the last man. And then if it gets down to a point of, look, here are the terms, you know, then maybe you talk about it. But I don't like the preemptive surrender element to it. Right. Of let's stop funding Ukraine because we know they're going to lose, that sort of thing. Or we'll fund you as long as you give up. I think that's
well, yeah. Right, I essentially, you're right.
That's either the Ukrainians or to Putin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what he's arguing, what a number of people are arguing is just that well, we should fund you or help you so long as you're willing to give up something, right? And it's not like that in and of itself is completely unreasonable. I mean, certainly if we thought,
well, that, I think it is, but
there's a point in which it's not. Let's say we decided, well, Ukraine needs $1 trillion. Would I be willing to commit $1 trillion of U.S. money to Ukraine so that they could potentially take back those eastern regions? A trillion? I don't think so. You know, there's a price tag at which would $10 trillion be too much? Yeah, I think you would agree. $10 trillion would be too much, right?
Yeah, but there's
but that's my point.
Is there a deal on the table?
Well, there's not a deal on the table yet.
Is there something to accept?
Right.
Is there? And when, as a matter of statecraft, when we communicate listen, we'll fund you if you accept this, are we perhaps putting a deal on the table that might not be there, right? That there shouldn't be there.
And I certainly agree with you on this issue. And so I find myself in a sort of a bizarro world situation of putting myself in J.D. Vance's head on this issue and kind of making that argument. It's not a place I feel very comfortable in for a lot of reasons. But I did want to point that argument out, though I do in the end disagree with it. But I think it's at least worth
mentioning. Yeah, I mean, to me, the idea of, come on, be reasonable, give up part of your country.
Yeah.
That strikes me as unreasonable.
You know, and I think there's a scenario
of any country that's been unlawfully invaded.
But on the other hand, it's not crazy to say, hey, we're going to give you $60 billion. We'd like to see a plan.
Yeah.
I mean, and so there's some room in between there, right? Certainly.
And do we get into the, I mean, is in say looking at Vietnam, right? Wasn't that sort of a lot of the calculation that we sort of got involved in there, right? Of listen, we can only fund this to so much and we'll give you this much, but we want to have these negotiations and we want, you know what I mean? There's sort of a sense of, you know, willingness to give up on something, which in the end means giving up on everything.
Well, yeah, I don't necessarily.
I don't know if I said that.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I don't agree with that formulation of it necessarily. And I don't think we're at the point that J.D. Vance believes, or at least ostensibly believes, we're at. And I think it's possible, for instance, you know, now they're part of this latest aid package. They're getting a bunch of things like those attack-em missiles, longer range missiles. And I mean, they already have some of them, but more of a lot of other things. There's not an unreasonable chance that they'll be able to destroy or at least seriously impair traffic on the Kerch Bridge that connects Russia to the Crimea. And a lot of things could still happen that can make life a lot tougher or Russia, certainly. And then there's the whole argument of, well, do we get some sort of other benefit out of significantly degrading one of our main strategic rivals? And yes, we do, I would say. And so I guess if I felt that we were at the situation, at the point J.D. Vance thought we were at, I'd be more open to his argument. But I don't think Ukraine is there yet. I still think Ukraine has a better shot of at least some reasonable shot with between our support and Europe's support of getting Russia out of almost the entirety of the country, or at least being in a much better position than it's at now.
And I think it's important to remember that when this war started, everyone sort of assumed that Russia would take over all of Ukraine in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
The best, brightest military minds and everyone seemed in agreement that that's what was going to happen. And here we are a year and a half, no, not quite a year and a half, but over a year down the road. And, you know, the people are grouching that it's a stalemate. Well, you know, to some extent, a failed invasion is not necessarily a stalemate, right? The Russians certainly have not accomplished what they set out to do, and they have had to incur much higher costs than they anticipated. And the other point, which is always the point for me, right, is I don't think it's a choice of are we spending money in Ukraine or are we spending money to buck up Taiwan. To me, it's one and the same.
Right?
Because sending that message that we won't tolerate this sort of behavior sends a message. And I think if we do the opposite message of, well, we're willing to concede something, that sends a bad message. That tells the Chinese, well, yeah, they're not really going to fight for Taiwan. Maybe they put up some token effort, but it'll be over soon. So that's...
And it's a matter of...
My foreign policy views may or may not represent those of our, you know, sponsors and management, or that of the Republican Party typically today. But
I think it's also a matter of how long you stick it out. And, you know, it's just a little bit over 2 years since Russia invaded. The first year went really well for Ukraine. So the question is, well, do we have more patience than a year of kind of stalemate and slog? And I should hope we would. And so I'm certainly with you on this.
So, and one last thing that I think shouldn't be overlooked is one of the ways they got this deal done was a Trump idea. Instead of treating these payments as, you know, pure aid, they're treated as loans. And I think that's good, because that did give, I think, a lot of Republicans cover that this isn't just money we're throwing away. Now, those loans may be forgiven. You know, I suppose if
like student loans, you're saying kind of like this.
Yeah, I think they may well be forgiven and written off immediately. But look, that's the approach we had to, you know, foreign policy aid in the past. It was our approach to England in World War II, even. This is a lend-lease program, right? So I think that was a good idea. It's a good political compromise. And I think it gets the Ukrainians the money they need, and it gives enough Republicans cover to vote for it.
Yeah, go Ukraine. When I mentioned those three bills, I mentioned there was a fourth bill as well that was bundled in to them, and that was the TikTok ban. Actually, in the House, it was called the 21st Century Peace Through Strength Act, and we're all for peace through strength, I would say. Good title. And that passed with...
That's kind of a weird title.
You know, some of them are.
Banning an app.
I
think that's your military appropriation bill kind of thing, right? I mean, it's sort of the...
It was maybe a late night. I don't know. They were doing a lot. Peace through thing. That sounds good. Yeah, let's go with that. But it can't be the banned TikTok bill, because that just sounds, you know, anyway. But the point is, whatever it was called, it passed with really strong support in the House, 360 to 58. And the 58 no votes were pretty evenly split. I mean, there were 33 from Democrats, 25 from Republicans. So, and what the bill would do, which also was in that combined measure the Senate passed, it would force ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company, to find a new approved buyer within a year or have it banned in the United States. Now, ByteDance will be suing to block the implementation of the law. But even if the courts end up ruling against the company, which I think they will, there's a good chance that TikTok will probably be up and running in the U.S. until, I would say, at least sometime in 2026. And the argument for the ban is that as a Chinese company, ByteDance can be compelled by China's government to give up data on its users. There's this 2017 Chinese national security law, or just, you know, the Chinese ruling party comes to your door and says, hey, we want that information. Yeah. Do you really think ByteDance is going to say, go suck it? You know, I'll see you in court. I don't think so. Now, TikTok, I don't believe they filed the lawsuit yet, but when they do, they're likely to base their constitutional argument, which is going to be their claim that's unconstitutional, on some combination of First Amendment free speech rights, maybe arguing that it's a bill of attainder, which is unconstitutional, or it violates the takings clause. Honestly, I don't think there's much there, at least how I envision it, but it would be enough certainly to give them more time to figure out some sort of negotiation or sale or something like that. So that's my take. Jay, what do you think, first off, about the bill actually, the legislation actually banning or doing this? And secondly, what you think might happen?
Well, I think one thing I think for an important constitutional piece is it doesn't ban TikTok. It requires a sale.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, when we talked about this before, I said, I think there are some significant First Amendment questions, right? If you can say, I'm going to ban some news outlet, which for, you know, good or bad, I would say TikTok is essentially a news outlet. I think that presents a First Amendment problem. The reasons for the ban, though, and setting this up and saying, well, listen, it ought to be in a U.S. company, or at least not Chinese, that makes it a little different. And I think this is probably one of those, I could see this being one of these really rare cases where you say, yeah, this affects First Amendment rights, strict scrutiny applies. But I think this bill could pass strict scrutiny in that doesn't seem to be any less restrictive means of getting there. And we've got something that it's not just a viewpoint that's being censored, obviously. It's the entire, the issue to me is not what views TikTok might put out there, but rather the infiltration of people's hardware, right? Of their phones, of their computers. So to that point, I'm a little turned off by. There have been folks who have been arguing, well, one of the reasons we need to ban it is because it could be a major source of misinformation in an election and all that sort of thing. Because I don't think those concerns rise to the level that would pass strict scrutiny, right? So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I think it's a good bill, but I would focus not on the idea of you know, should be. I'm not afraid of Chinese misinformation. I'm afraid of Chinese hacking and, you know, shutting down people's phones, shutting down vital systems, all that sort of thing.
Well, it's more. I mean, there are serious privacy implications as well.
Right.
I mean, and so if ByteDance in its user agreement that nobody reads, right, with people who download TikTok, they say they ensure that certain privacy rights will be kept. And we know that the Chinese, or we have good reason to believe that the Chinese government will be able to get access to that information and use it against U.S., you know, the U.S. population. Well, that's a significant enough.
Or just sell it.
Yeah.
Sell it to hackers.
Yeah,
right?
And that's a significant enough national security concern to make it be able to survive strict scrutiny. And so it would be if it weren't the Chinese government, if it were, I don't know, like the French government or something that owned it, this would be a much harder case to make, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and would you agree with my analysis that probably it's going to be a couple of years before we see anything actually happen on the ground with this in terms of people actually using TikTok?
Well, I don't know, because it depends on when we effective date would be on the bill.
So it's 90 days, or sorry, it's 9 months from the time it's signed, which was this last week, but the president can do a 90-day extension. So it basically makes it a year. As I understand, what ByteDance seems to be planning to do is waiting as long as possible to file their lawsuit, so that way when it's tied up in the courts, and so I add a year and like the legal process,
and
it gets us into probably 2026 or so forth. But
right, although they would have to at some point file for injunctive relief to prevent it from coming into effect at that point, which I'm not sure they get.
Good point. So yeah, so it's at least a year, probably a little bit more, but it would depend on them finding a sympathetic judge in a jurisdiction, right, who wants to issue some sort of nationwide injunction. It seems like you can find one of those if you look hard enough these days, but that's another story. So, all right. Anything else on the TikTok ban you want to get into?
No, not really. Okay. I think there's going to be more to talk about as time goes on. I think there may be, it'll be interesting to see what kind of buyers are out there and how they're vetted, right? If they're legit buyers, or could we have American companies that would be American in name only, but still controlled some, you know, surreptitiously by the Chinese or something. I think those will be issues as we move forward.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, let's move on to something different. College protests. You know, there've been a bunch of them concerning Israel's actions in Gaza, I'll say. You know, initially it was sort of a small number of campuses, but they've been spreading over the last week. I mean, Columbia's at the center of the protests, and they moved their classes online for the rest of the semester. USC just went from canceling a speaker to just outright canceling their main commencement in May. And there have been, at this point, hundreds of arrests, suspensions of student protesters. I mean, it's become not just a thing at a few schools, but a real bigger thing than that. And to me, it's always difficult to say what the protesters want when you're talking about a varied group all over the place. But I think in this case, we can say, well, more generally, they want to put pressure on the U.S. government to stop supporting Israel in what a lot of them see as, right, the term they use is genocide in Gaza. And plenty of the protesters are also demanding that their schools divest in any kind of investments they might have in what the students, the protesters, are, they're not all students, see as aiding Israel's war efforts or being anti-Palestinian or something like that. So, Jay, I know you're a free speech guy. You believe in all that kind of stuff. So I'm wondering what you think both about these protests and also about how universities have been responding to them to this point.
So I am a free speech guy, and which is one of the reasons that I think a couple things. One, I think what's going on right now, right, where we've got these mobs blocking entrances, blocking students, harassing students, poking students in the eye with flagpoles, that's not free speech, and that would not be protected speech. I would say statements saying "up with Hamas," you know, "burn Tel Aviv to the ground," "we hate the Jews," all that, I think that is protected speech. And I would make the argument that if someone wants to say that or hold that in a sign, that's protected.
Let me ask you on that, Jay. So you would be okay with people, groups chanting "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free"? As far as you're concerned, that's okay.
I wouldn't say it's okay. I would say it's constitutionally permitted.
Right. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I think. In a public university, it would be constitutionally permitted, and I think arguably, if you value free speech, I think that's universities ought to apply those values. My issue on that is the same issue that came up when the college presidents from Harvard and MIT and Penn first went before Congress. Is that these colleges can't have it both ways, right? Where the kid with a MAGA hat, you know, and the old "this is speech is violence" sort of thing, is subject to discipline. But the mob chasing down Jewish students depends on the circumstances, or, you know, that seems to have gone unpunished. And you actually have faculty marching, objecting to suspensions of students who engaged in violence. The First Amendment doesn't give you a right to camp out, you know, in front of buildings and campus. It doesn't give you a right to disrupt classes. It doesn't give you a right to harass or terrify people. And there's also something which you mentioned, in the river to the sea, and this is, there's, you know, what's called the doctrine of fighting words. Which, it's one thing to say it, it's another thing to say it in a time or place when it might incite violence. So I think there are those caveats as well. So if someone wants to put a, you know, post a sign on their door in their dorm saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. To me, I think that's protected speech, unless, you know, something, there's something else going on there that would suggest that there's an imminent threat. Now, it's kind of funny. I was thinking back the hazy days of many, many, many years ago, early 90s. I was involved with it was a pro free speech bill. We tried to get through the Ohio House. And one of our cases, one of the things that brought this up was there was a student at the University of Cincinnati who put a sign on his door. And it said, this was when the debate over same-sex marriage had first surfaced, right? Early 90s. And he said, no rights for sodomites, which is clever as slogans go.
It's important that they rhyme, you know, river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Rhyming's always a big thing.
Yeah. It's got to rhyme. And conservatives usually aren't good at that. But anyway, this kid, for putting his sign on the door of, you know, saying no rights for sodomites, was, you know, hauled before the dean and you know, punishment was delivered. It, to me, I think that's what bothers so many conservatives about colleges and universities right now is the double standard. And then secondarily from that, the gaslighting about the double standard, right? That there's, oh, no, there's no double standard. I guarantee you, if there was a camp of MAGA support or a Stop the Steal camp out in Columbia, that would have been shut down in short order. But,
you know, maybe I'm not disagreeing, but I feel like it's dangerous to get into this what would happen if hypothetical sort of thing, because that's when we start to assume bad faith on the part of people who are involved. And I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm just going to not even engage in that because I don't. Just because I think it's just become sort of a fruitless side of like, well, they hate us. And I want to focus on the facts as we know them. And it seems to me.
Fair enough. But I do want to point out one other, you know, we talked about a Supreme Court case a couple months back about someone who was suing over UVA, not UVA, it was Virginia Tech's policy with, I'm forgetting what they called the organizations, but it was the, you know, see something, say something.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, anyone could anonymously report anyone or any microaggression, at which point they would be called before this committee or get a call from the dean to come out and have a sit down. And to me, that was a troubling thing. Now, my sense is any of this, what's going on now, certainly would have qualified for those microaggressions, but you don't see them being rigorously prosecuted.
And I get,
I just don't think they would be.
Yeah. And I get that a lot of people, it seems like, I'll say, especially on the right, but it's also on the left as well, want to make everything a culture war issue. And hey, if people want to talk about it in that way, and that's why it's such a hot issue. But to me, I think that the tragedy of where we're at now in this country in general is that the way we should be talking about this is as a free speech issue, not a culture war issue. I don't care what they're arguing for. I mean, I care, certainly. But whether it's Stop the Steal or Palestine should be free from the river to the sea, I mean, I've spent my life on college campuses, right? And I feel like, hey, as long as you're not in somebody's face and people can get the classes, have at it, and you're not inciting violence, whatever you want to say, you know, reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, that's fine.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I'm just noting that from the conservative standpoint, and look, from this is my personal experience, having seen a lot of these cases, you know, from a legal standpoint, from the guy at Marietta who was fired for refusing to use the right pronouns. You know what I'm saying? This, that people see a double standard, and that's why there's that issue. Again, my position would be like yours. I'm a free speech guy, and even if you say something that is hateful, ridiculous, hurtful, whatever, that's free speech, and the response to that is, you know, more speech, or sometimes they're just ignoring it.
I guess there's another aspect of this, Jay, that I don't know, just make me sound like a cranky old guy, but I feel like if you're going to protest and hey, Have at it. If you're going to protest, and if you decide you're going to protest in a way that you know is illegal, okay, have at it again. Change yourself to that nuclear power plant or do whatever.
Yeah.
But don't come to me and act all outraged like you're somehow being horrifically violated if you end up in jail because of that. In fact, I mean, have the courage of your convictions, I guess, is what I'm saying. And so in a way, I respect protest to say I'm willing to suffer for this, but the idea that you're going to stop an institution from performing its basic function and expect them just to sort of do what you want because of your intimidations and not have any repercussions, that to me is just, wow. I don't know. It's just.
Well, I mean, I was, this occurred to me that actually this morning, it's sort of like to paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message, right? And I think that sort of gets into where we, you know, are with some of these protests, that they're not designed to, hey, here's our point of view, we'd like you to take it under consideration, or we demand action on this or that. It's we want to shut things down, we want to burn stuff down, we want to. I mean, I think there's a sense by a lot of these folks, I think they want to force the confrontation to get arrested because that gets them the headlines, that gets them the attention. And then there is some of, look, with college kids, there is some of this that's performative, attention seeking. It's a big adventure, you know, sort of thing. Because look, you and I have been there.
And I think you're right. There are some people who get swept up in these things, and there are some, you know, there's, oh, let's go to the protest. You know, I've got nothing to do today, or seems like, you know, it seems to better than my political science class. And so, yeah, and things happen. Very few good things happen in protesting mobs as a general rule.
In crowds, yeah, exactly, yeah.
But I also, I guess, feel, and it makes me wonder if institutions are reacting, I would argue they're within their rights doing what they're doing, but if it actually is not that smart to do what they're doing, because I could see an argument that, like, listen, it's late April. Summer break's going to be pretty soon. What if we just kind of don't overreact, don't arrest them, and just kind of work around them and just let it kind of fizzle out? Do we really want to arrest them and suspend them and to lend fuel to this fire? And I mean, that's not a completely crazy argument.
It's not crazy, but I don't think it's a good argument, because then what happens next fall?
And it's also, right? Yeah.
I think there is the sense of, look, we got away with this much last time. We should be able to get away with more next time.
Well, but the counter to that is, well, we did this and nothing happened, and so why should we bother doing it again? Though I will point out there are just some practical realities. If you have people blocking entrances and making it difficult for folks to actually do stuff, then that becomes a problem, essentially. So, yeah. I mean, and I guess
I would point out something else that's a little different about these protests, if you want to call them just, you know, protests, or maybe demonstrations might be a better word, is I understand, and you and I have talked about this a number of times, one can disagree with the state of Israel or its foreign policy or its policy towards Palestinians and not be anti-Semitic. But there is also a high overlap of people who are anti-Semitic who would tend to disagree with Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, and then expand that into Israel's right to exist, period, or the Jewish people's right to exist, period. And I think there is certainly an element of that that's going on. And it's changed, right? It's in recent weeks that this is actually, now you have people chanting support for Hamas, not simply saying, hey, we, you know, Palestine will be free, but hey, we're with the people who murdered intentionally civilians, babies, etc. And again, the message is the medium, right?
I think if you're someone who cares deeply about this and you feel that what Israel is doing is at best wildly disproportionate, and most of the people who are protesting would say that that's not even, that doesn't come close to how they feel, then what avenues are open to you? And they would say, well, here's something we can do that can, how else can we pressure the system? And that's not a unreasonable approach to that at all. So they could say, well, if we do enough of this, then it gives Biden and the administration more cover in talking with Netanyahu and the Israeli government, saying, listen, you got to give us something because the kids are going crazy across the country and we need some kind of concession. And so I can see where they would
say, and Netanyahu would rightfully respond, yeah, like the kids that were murdered at the music festival, they had issues too. So tell your kids to
And Netanyahu being the thug that he is, might say that. And I think the argument to that would be, well, now how many Palestinians have you guys killed in your counter to that? Again, and so I guess I'm torn because on a lot of the policy type stuff, I probably am at least certainly more in agreement with the protesters than you are. I wouldn't call it genocide, but I would call it deeply and fundamentally wrong in a lot of ways. And so I understand to a certain extent why they're doing what they're, why they're feeling what they're feeling. And this, they are believing this being their best chance of affecting some sort of change. And so I'm not entirely unsympathetic to what they're doing, I guess, because of that.
Do you think that part of, with some of these people who are protesting, though, the change they would like to see would be the Jews wiped out?
I think that's the thing
that they're requesting, right? I mean, and when you praise Hamas, that is something different than saying we oppose Israeli overreaction to the Palestinian Hamas attack.
I definitely think there are some people in these protests who are rabid anti-Semites and who would love nothing more than to see every Jew extinguished in some sort of Holocaust. But I also, by the same token, I think that there are, you know, some people in the Republican Party who are just virulent racist who would love to see lynchings return and so forth. But that doesn't mean that I think that is characteristic of the Republican.
I think
you're wrong. You're right.
Let's put it this way. You don't see people massing in college campuses saying bring back lynchings.
No, but we've seen protests in the recent past, where there were protesters holding up just horrifically racist signs. You know, racist groups talking about their support for Donald Trump, right? But yeah, you would rightly argue, and at the time you did rightly argue, well, hey, that's like some small group that's latching on to this thing to push their message of hate, and it's not representative. I would argue that that's the exact same thing that's happening here.
Yeah, I'd make the distinction that these are the children of the elite at our elite universities. Who will be
but,
the corporate
but they're not
leaders,
all.
Media
I mean,
leaders,
I mean, a lot of these people
of
are
the future.
A lot
and
of these
something
people.
Different
a lot of these
than,
people
than a
are
bunch
not.
Of hillbillies in Charlottesville.
I guess I'm just sort of, I don't know how to respond to that. So, are you saying that you think that the people who are the small number of people in these groups who are saying clearly anti-Semitic, kill the Jews, destroy Israel type of thing, not people who are getting wound up in chants about from the river to the sea, but people who are saying in these groups who are saying that they want to see Jews killed because they're Jews, that you think that these people are the future leaders of our society?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, look, if they're chanting this stuff, if they're praising Hamas, if they're going to be graduating from these institutions, right, which we call our elite institutions.
And but you're making making a huge leap here. You're saying that, I love the chain of logic here. You're saying that, well, if somebody says go Hamas, they are thinking in their head, they're saying, okay, I'm saying go Hamas because what I mean by that is I know that Hamas is very much committed to the destruction of Israel. And so I am therefore by proxy saying destroy Israel. And if I am in a position of power, I will do what I can to promote the destruction of Israel. Because at some rally at Columbia 10 years ago, I chanted go Hamas. I find that to be completely incredible.
My point that I'm trying to make is the people who are chanting go Hamas are not on the fringes of society.
Sure. And that's fair. Yeah.
The folks at Charlottesville were. You could say, I mean, you could say, look, here's a bunch of, you know, crazy racist hillbillies. Do they really hold any levers of power? No. I mean, does someone support Donald Trump? Yeah. But I think it's something different entirely when it is the most well-off, the most privileged of our society who are saying these things.
Like,
right?
Like for instance,
well, look, they're kids, they're getting caught up in the excitement, and maybe they don't realize what Hamas really is or what it really means. And I think there's a lot of that, right? And maybe years down the road, hopefully, when these people come up for a confirmation hearing or whatever, they can make that case to the Senate and say, listen, I was a kid, I didn't know what I was saying. But
let's be clear, on the right, I mean, and you're saying there's no comparison. On the right, we have a former president of the United States and currently the person who is leading in the polls to become the next president of the United States, who has publicly multiple times called people from Central America animals, not even human.
Yeah.
And so it's not like there aren't people who are holding levers of power who are not saying these things. I'm just saying this is not some sort of thing that's on the left here, right? And we have people who are cheering him on who hold levers of power, who are saying the exact same sort of things about immigrants. So I just wanted to point that out. So I think there's a problem to just say, well, the people who are crazy, who are saying crazy things about, you know, these folks or folks who aren't what us are just some hillbillies, as you put it. I mean, they're the Donald Trump, right? Not some hillbilly.
All right. Fair enough. Donald Trump, not a hillbilly.
Okay. So what do you think? I mean, in terms of practical impact, you think that this will keep on growing, or is there going to be...
Let me just jump in one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think, assuming Donald Trump's trial, you know, he gets some time off from that to campaign, do you think he would be allowed to speak at any college or university in the United States?
What do you mean by allowed?
Like, would they allow him on campus?
I would.
If
I
Donald
would.
Trump said, I wanted to walk on, I'm going to go, I've got an afternoon break from the trial. I'm going to walk over to Columbia, get a bullhorn, and make a speech about how rotten Hamas is.
Well, again, I think that gets into that. I know what you want me to say, and but I'm not going to say.
No, I mean, I'm not. Okay. I'm not trying to bait you. I'm
okay.
Saying.
I'm going to say, I don't know. I'm going to say, I would hope that the leaders at wherever it is, I guess he'd probably go to Columbia, right? Because the trial's, you know, close enough.
Right. That's the closest.
Just drive it or take him there. I would hope that they would say, well, listen, as long as you don't violate any of our restrictions we put on any speaker, we certainly won't prohibit you. And we will do our best to provide security. But if there becomes a security problem, we will ask you for the security of the campus to leave, as we would any other speaker who is posing a security
risk. As we would Judge Duncan, yeah.
As we would anyone.
I get it.
So, yeah. I would hope they would do that. And I would love to see him try it because I would let's see. But that would be, I think you would agree, the correct response, though you would.
I agree. I would hope that they would say that too. But.
So I'd like to see it. So, but I don't think we will. So on these protests, I mean, do you think that they're going to keep on gaining in power, or are the kids just going to get sort of tired of it with summer break?
Well, some of it is like, yeah, look, school's going to be out and a lot of them are going to go home. I think there's going to be some of that. My guess is the locale of the protests might move. And you might see less on college campuses and more just, you know, on the city streets.
Well, I don't necessarily think so. I think it's just sort of going to slow down, kind of peter out and that. And I think it's different than something like, say, the George Floyd protests, which were a lot bigger, certainly. And they involved a domestic, not an international issue. And that matters, I think, as well, that was part of a lot of people's lived experience in this country. But also, I think an important difference is there were sort of some at least legislative, executive action kind of paths, things that could be plausibly done. And when we look at the situation with U.S. support for Israel, I just don't see the politics lining up in such a way that really anything more than Joe Biden talking very sternly to Netanyahu, you know, is going to happen, right? And if I'm Netanyahu, I'm thinking, well, let's just hope the presidential election in the U.S. goes my way and I'll be able to work with my buddy Donald and things will be a lot better. So that's why I don't really see there being any kind of a way or any sort of, you know, significant change to be enacted as a result of this, at least in the short term.
Well, I would think that Biden, well, I mean, there's always threat of sanctions against the one IDF unit. There could be more of that. But don't you think this is going to keep building momentum to Chicago?
I guess I could see that. Yeah. And so if nothing else,
you think the people, first of all, I would point out, I think you would agree with me that the folks who are really organizing these protests, these are not organic student movements popping up.
I don't know. I don't think it's some sort of the spontaneous grassroots sort of thing as they get into the dorm room with a spray paint can and a banner and say, yeah, let's make. Yeah, no, no, of course not.
Yeah. So this is, and in my sense is the people who are organizing this have a bigger, broader plan. And that plan will run throughout the summer and up through the Democratic convention.
Well, and the weird thing about that is the sort of irony, I guess, of that is that that could be a plan that would be really good for helping Donald Trump get elected and just going against,
yes, exactly would, yeah.
against
yeah.
what they want. I mean, because if you're a supporter of Palestinian rights and you're asked to choose between Joe Biden or Donald Trump as president of the United States, that's a pretty easy choice, I would think.
But for some people, right, and the polls seem to show this, they're single issue voters, right? And they might not vote for Donald Trump, but they might not go to the polls for Joe Biden either.
Yeah, and so they'll end up maybe by default getting Donald Trump and shooting themselves in the foot
right.
for that reason. And I sure hope that's not the case. But well, we shall see what happens with the protests. Anything else on that, Jay?
No, that's about it.
Okay, well, that's enough, I think.
Other than my daughter at Ohio State texted me that she was upset because they had to close the union because of the protest, and she really wanted to go get a meatball sub. And so,
it's a thing affecting you personally, or at least your family.
I would have been Mike in the day. I would have been out counter protesting.
Yeah, you would have. Yes, I would have been. I probably
and I,
when I was at that
I,
point.
Some
I probably
part of me
have
feels bad that. Here I am now. But,
well, you know, you do what you can, Jay. So anyway, so hey, before we go, if there was anything that Jay and I talked about that you disagreed with, you got a question about.
Oh, there was.
Well, let us know. mail@politicsguys.com. Also, there's Facebook. There's X. If you're one of our supporters, there's the Discord group where we get all kinds of stuff. Right before the show went on, someone was asking me, what the hell is Jay talking about? But I forget what it was now, but they were not happy anyway. Maybe we'll bring that up. So, but
I haven't even been on in like 2 weeks.
It doesn't matter, Jay. You know, you're a perennial, right? They know who you are. Anyway, so, but we hope you will consider becoming a supporter, and you get the Discord with that. You get the ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get the full-length midweek episode, not just that like 15-minute or so preview that we put out there. A bunch of stuff. Hope you check it all out. You can just go to patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support. You'll find links in today's show notes as well. You can also support us on PayPal or Venmo if you would prefer that to Patreon. And if you would like to get that full-length midweek episode, but you just can't afford to support us right now, you got other things going on, not a problem. Send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. I will get that set up for you. And whether you support us or not financially, one thing you can do that doesn't cost you anything, and it really does help us out a lot, is just take a minute in the podcast app you're listening in, rate us, review us. That really does matter. We really would appreciate it. And finally, before we go, as always, a special thanks to our fantastic executive producers. They are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.